Being a computer scientist, I thought I wouldn't use a computer, I'd use a old-fashioned technology. So what I'd like to give you is a computer science perspective on the data deluge. And one thing I'd like to draw out from this slide is that I'm from the Department of Electronics and Computer Science, which is actually a very exciting blend of the technologies and the software hardware technologies, and also the software technologies we'll need to exploit them. So, I want to go back to 1945 to a man named Vannevar Bush, who had a vision. He was a scientist, and he wrote this one paper on a vision, if you like, of the World Wide Web, of the Xanadu project of Ted Nelson. A possible world where there was so much data that you couldn't use it, you couldn't possibly find your way through it. You had to have trails and you had to have links through it. And what he has on his head is what he called a memory expander, a memex device. But this vision of the future is not a million miles away from the World Wide Web and the data deluge that we have today. So, Vannevar Bush in 1945 had a wonderful vision of putting all the world's repositories of data online and being able to search it and follow experts in finding their way through it. What's driving the data explosion, the data deluge? Well, I'd like to just remind you a little bit about Moore's Law. This is the thing that has been driving the revolution for the last 30 years or more, and it's the following. It's Gordon Moore, who was one of the founders of Intel, propounded the following understanding. He has one of the patents on the original integrated circuits, the planar integrated circuits. He realized that shrinking the circuit makes it go faster, and on a given size wafer you can get more chips on it, and it doesn't cost you any more because it's only made out of silicon, which is sand, and it's all very cheap, and you can actually halve the price of computing, and doubles about every 18 months, and it's set to continue for 10 years or so. And just to show you that, this is the increase in processing power over a period from 1980s up to projected up to 2010. You may wonder about these specific details at this point. I think you will see that actually it begins to slow down around 2005. But nonetheless, a fairly impressive increase in performance. It's the reason you have to throw away your computer every 2 years. Right? Very irritating. But it will come to an end. But the other thing you should notice, this is the cost of computing. In 30 years, it's gone down. And so, in some sense, there was a trade-off between, you know, storing data or just recalculating it, because it's so cheap to recalculate the data if you're doing simulations of data. So this is driving the information revolution. And relevant to tonight is a nice foil, which is the same time as we're talking about computers processing. By the year 2010 or so, you will have 100 billion transistors on a DRAM, which is as many transistors on a chip as there are stars in your galaxy, and they're all collected together, 10 to the 11th, a large number. So what does that mean? That means that the foils I've shown you for processor speed are also true of memory speed, of memory capacity. And so the capacity of memory, this is in 10 to the 12th bits, so a megabit is a million bits, this is a million bits, and this is the installed growth. And what I'd like to draw your attention here, this is the rate of growth. It's well over 50% each year, the percentage change. So in 1999, and years before, we've installed this much memory. By the year 2001, we'll have installed more memory than have ever been installed up to this point. It's really a terrifying prospect. So there's huge amounts of memory. It's driven by Moore's Law. Moore's Law, you'll be interested to know, will be coming to an end. And what happens then? Well, that's an interesting question and the subject of another talk. So, what about the data deluge? I'm going to talk about a specific type of data, namely simulation data produced by these high-performance computers. Parallel computing is just putting lots of these computers together, so you now have machines with tens of thousands of processors all working together. It's like you know, herding cats to make them work on the same problem in the right way, at the right order. It's a complicated problem. But this is just to show you the benefits of this. This is a foil from British Aerospace that used to be now BAE Systems, of course. This is on the Airbus design. The target design was a 10% reduction in drag compared to the A310. They don't worry about takeoff and landing. If you crash or land, it's very rare. But what they do, they spend at 30,000 feet, they use a lot of airline fuel. So you can increase the fuel economy there, you save literally millions and millions of dollars. So using computational fluid dynamics, using computers, they were able to test 800 wing designs over 2 years. They looked at 100 variants in the last 6 weeks. And the computer time was completely trivial, half a million. To achieve the same via the wind tunnel testing, building models for 800 sets of wings, was 65 million estimate, and the time required 150 years. Okay. So, but as you can imagine, that generates a huge quantity of data. So just to give you some feel for that, I'll talk about a little project we did at Southampton with the UK Turbulence Consortium. They do computational fluid dynamics on the national supercomputer up in Manchester. And they need to store results for each configuration of the aeroplane or whatever. 100 time steps requires hundreds of gigabytes. That's 1,000 million bytes. And so on these sort of present day challenges and present supercomputing challenges, you want to store all these different things and you want to address them, you want to analyze them. This is a consortium based over the whole of the UK. You want to talk with a colleague in Glasgow and discuss the data, and you need to be able to reference it and file it and understand that you can look at the same piece of data. So instead of storing things in files on computers, what you need to do is develop extra layers of data which tell the computer about the data. And so what we developed was a web-based mechanism for storing, searching, and retrieval of this simulation data. And it uses some techniques from the latest database language, SQL3, to give you database management of scientific metadata. I'll talk about that in a moment. And these large distributed files, which could be all over the UK. And anybody can get it without knowing anything about databases, because the web is a point-and-click technology. Okay. What I'd like then to do in the bulk of the remaining time is just pick a few results which I hope will interest you from a workshop which took place between the European Union representatives and the National Science Foundation in the States. It took place in America last year, and they made some interesting observations which I'd like to share with you and might change your view of data slightly. First of all, they, like Roger, had some ideas about how to explain how large a petabyte is. It's big enough to store a few high-resolution images for every human being on Earth. That's in a petabyte. Alternatively, you put it on mag tapes, it would take a whole railway carriage full of tapes to store one petabyte. If you have only one tape drive and you have a petabyte to look at, it will take you 3 years to stream a petabyte through one tape drive. It's a lot of data. Okay, so Roger was talking about a great deal of data. What is metadata? So metadata is data about data. So if you like, it's the analog of libraries. You have catalogs, indices, directory structures, and so on. And librarians work with books, and these all have what's called a schema, which is, you know, each book has a title, author, or authors, publisher, date, and so on. And that's the schema for a librarian. What we have for these different communities, you'll hear about the bioinformatics community, we've heard about the particle physics community, I'm talking about the simulation community, engineering community. They have different schemas that are required to record facts about the data. You need these facts because you need to be able to get different people's data working together. They've stored them in different ways. You need to actually tell the computer about what's in the data file and be able to manipulate them to search. And if you want to construct what's called intelligent search agents that can go away and find the data that you're looking for, you need the metadata layer on top, as well as the actual physical data. So you'll be generating petabytes not only of real data, like Roger was talking about, and I'm sure we'll hear about in the bioinformatics, but lots of simulation data. I think there will be increasingly a need to look at simulation output in the same way as a digital library. Now, digital libraries are an extension of ordinary, familiar physical libraries, and they're usually for archiving text, audio, video, and so on. For example, at Southampton, we have the Mountbatten Archives, where my colleague Wendy Hall addressed the problem of how to store this sort of uncorrelated, difficult to organise data, and it's a very difficult problem to get it and to be able to search it and so on. We're also doing in a project, we're doing the Churchill Archive, and I thought I'd show you a typical entry from the Churchill Archive. It's Winston Churchill's school report. Right. So this is 1884, and you won't be able to read it, but I'll read it for you. This is the general comments, very bad, is a constant trouble to everybody, and is always in some scrape or other. Clearly that boy will go nowhere. Right. Okay, so those are digital libraries, and the introduction slightly overstated the case. I was head of department and helped Wendy Hall start up a digital library. Well, Wendy Hall has taught me all I know about digital libraries, so I should give that acknowledgement. Okay, but so digital libraries, we're having search tools for digital libraries. That was the vision of Vannevar Bush. What we're doing now is scientific data. We require slightly different tools. We apply tools for transforming it in different ways, for doing data mining, finding the type of bit of data we want, and also we want to be able to visualize. We want to be able to walk around virtually the data and find out what the quirks are, what would happen if I changed this. So visualization tools, data mining, transformation tools. So what we need for these distributed collaborations that Roger was talking about and that I'm talking about with these simulation collaborations, but also about this bioinformatics, which is a worldwide collaboration, to work with different types of databases and so on, you need a new kind of digital library with catalogues, finding aids, as well as the data. So the metadata is important, and we need to define those and get agreed enough standards to be able to usefully use data generated by people all around the world. I would like to leave you with this thought here from the report again. An emergence of a new research methodology. I don't know how the Royal Society will respond to this, but traditional scientific methodologies are theory and experiment. The last half of the 20th century, I would say, has seen the emergence of scientific simulation as a sort of third methodology. It doesn't quite have the prestige of the first two, but it's a vitally important discipline, certainly for industry. This century, the report argues, and I think it's plausible, you'll see the emergence of a fourth methodology, which they call collection-based research. Scientists will get the data in a way that it's published, but not like a journal with tables and graphs, but in a much more rich fashion, electronically, with metadata, which will enable them to mine, sift, and deduce knowledge from this mass of data. So a new type of research methodology will result from this huge amount of data. Another interesting thing the report recommends is a data rescue research centre. Now, have you ever tried to read your BBC micro floppy lately? You'll find it rather difficult. And actually, it's a real problem. How do we store data that we will still be able to read and use 20 years from now? Librarians have an answer. It's called microfiche. But the question is, can we move to a more high-tech answer? So what they observed was the problem for preservation and curation of data. You spent millions producing it, you've really got to look after it. Refreshment, replacing the same media, replication, copying to a new type of media, repackaging, where you may change the metadata, transformation, copy with the change to the content, you might change the way you look at it, and so on. And the centre would also examine what new media and metadata will best be future-proof, stand the test of time. So there were other interesting things in the report, but I thought I'd just pick out those highlights. What I'd like to end with is a scenario of the future. This is from a NASA report called Ultra-Fast Computing, and it has a nice title, which is called Compute as Fast as Engineers Can Think. Think about that. Right, so this is about the design of a reusable launch vehicle. It's a scenario that they paint for the future. And it's a multi-company spread out all over the USA, possibly globally. What they have to do is run the whole life cycle. They have life cycle economic codes, packaging, aerodynamics, structures, propulsion, performance, heat transfer, and so on. All these complicated programs. And what they want to do is choose, like we saw for the Boeing example, I mean, this could be a car design, it could be a plane design, but this is the NASA design. We need to switch between the conceptual design phases and the detailed design phases, because at the detailed design phase, you find something you made conceptually was wrong, and you have to go back. So you have to have the ability to go back and forth between the different phases of design to incorporate revisions of early design choices. So that was the sort of problem they were addressing, and it's, you know, maybe doing the wing in Boston and the fuselage in Toulouse. Right? So these are the assumptions they made. Companies are geographically dispersed. 1 week you have, because you have to actually have some drop-dead date. You've got two designs that whittle down to two. How do you choose between design A and design B? Well, first of all, you have to optimize each of them to the same level, and you have to choose an objective. And the objective here is to maximize the return on investment over the life of the vehicle, which is assumed to be 10 years with 36 launches a year. So you get extremely detailed. Profitability, whether this design is better than that design, will hinge on all sorts of small differences. For example, you might be able to do a very light vehicle, but it actually costs you more to do it, and you have to have a trade-off. So this is engineering trade-offs, and what they now use, companies like Rolls-Royce, British Aerospace, and so on, they use a technique called multidisciplinary optimization, and you have to agree on your methodology before you start this, and then you go ahead. And you want to be able to do this, you want to be able to do designs, you want to be able to answer what-if questions very early. And what they came up with, the functionalities required, well, Roger had 50,000 or so CPUs. Here they have a 10,000 CPU. There are already 10,000 CPU parallel machines capable of providing rapid simulation turnaround. You need to say, well, I can get that quite right. Why don't we change this? Get the results. You need agents which tell you of the whole design process to gather information, monitor the progress, issue warnings that something has gone wrong or what you should be doing. You need visualization and virtual reality capability to make a real-time movie. If you want to just find out how this thing handles in flight, it's actually useful to show it to a pilot actually as a movie as to exactly what happens. And you'd like to be able to change things. Well, if I change that, how will it handle? And so on. That's the dynamic behavior, very difficult thing to do. And you'd also like to be able to discuss with your collaborator in Boston from your home in Southampton. You'd be able to like to walk through the vehicle and say, well, I like to take off this. So what's inside? You point at this side of the vehicle, cover comes off and you can look inside and see what it is, and you can actually press virtually the image and you can do a calculation. You can say it'll maybe have pre-stored data or maybe do the calculation in real time. So you need to be able to have this what's called an immersive capability to discuss the designs. That's their vision of the future. And because my time is nearly up, I'll just give you one. This is from General Motors. I apologize for the quality. It was taken from the web. And I have to explain what this image is. Here is the author of the software, Randall C. Smith, and what he's doing is evaluating the interior design of a car, sorry about the quality, with a collaborator who happens not to be at his site. But in the simulation, he's talking around it. Here is the collaborator. He's represented as an avatar. This is a digital image of the person. And they will become very realistic. They will look like Roger Cashmore. They have the beard reproduced himself. So they will spend a lot of computer power getting your avatar's image right. And this is how you will be able to do simulation. These guys can go and walk out of the simulation to a three-dimensional immersive environment, and the calculation will still go on or whatever. And you can come in and run checks and so on. So this is, I've talked about Airbus, I've talked about NASA's launch vehicle. This is car design. This is what saved Rover, right? So these are the technology. You can't do that at the moment. It's beyond our capability. But it's just these sort of things that the e-science and e-engineering is something that's not being done in the commercial world. Commercial databases, data warehouse and so on, usually focus on mining corporate data to know that Tony Hay goes into Sainsbury's on Friday night and buys smoked salmon and champagne. They can have it waiting for me, right, to pick up, because they can do the mining of the data. And they can say, well, perhaps he'd also like some truffles and so on. But so they can sell more things. But that's a rather limited form of knowledge discovery from data. What we need to do with scientific data handling, the petabytes that Roger has, the petabytes that simulation have, I think it's not petabytes that informatics have, it's terabytes at the moment, but it will eventually be petabytes. they need to be very flexible in terms of access. You have to be very careful how you access them, how you store them, because it can take a huge amount of time to access data. So we need to get better knowledge discovery techniques. This is where computer science comes in. We need to design architectures that can retrieve data. And this is the test bed that will eventually find its way into the commercial marketplace. And again, the tele-immersion example I gave you with your avatar next to you integrates collaborative virtual reality, video conferencing, data mining with computation. This is not done in the commercial world. It will stretch the capability of networks, it will stretch the capability of computer scientists, and it will stretch the capability of scientists and engineers. Thank you very much.